Station. A day later, Ismail Khan's forces and a small team of CIA and special forces took Herat. With U.S. air power and support, Bismillah Khan's army blasted across the Shamali Plains, just as he had outlined to us. They seized Kabul. Bamiyan followed, as Khalili's Hazara Shia militia swept into their hometown. The Taliban and AQ losses mounted. Thousands of enemy dead littered the battlefields across northern Afghanistan. The rest were running for their lives. On 12 November, I was back in the White House Situation Room, providing the NSC principals an update. It did not take long. The collapse of enemy forces in northern Afghanistan had unfolded as described weeks earlier in the maps and briefings Director Tenet and I had provided. I explained the Humint, the Predator coverage, the special forces and CIA operatives on horseback, the fall of Kabul, and more. I showed them photos. In the next few days, our Afghan allies surrounded a large group of enemy fighters in the Kunduz pocket. Back at HQS, I got a call from CIA Public Affairs Officer Bill Harlow. "I have a request," he said. "Okay. A major U.S. newspaper has two journalists who are trapped, maybe lost, near Kunduz, and their satellite phone battery is almost dead. You want us to find them? Rescue them?" "Yes." "Give me their location, if you know it, and their phone number." I walked over to Massey and told him, including the name of the newspaper, whose editors and journalists routinely bashed the CIA.
This newspaper wants us to help them?"
John asked. He almost laughed.
"Yep."
"Well, that's ironic."
"Yep."
"Okay, we're on it." Within hours, a CIA team of Afghan commandos located and extracted the two journalists. The next day, Harlow called back.
"They are very grateful. They wanted me to thank you."
"I will pass that on to our men." About the same time, a CIA Afghan agent reported that the Taliban contingent holding the SNI hostages had fled south of Kabul. He dogged their trail relentlessly and finally spotted the SNI group, abandoned by the Taliban, who were now running for the Pakistan border. The CIA fed the intelligence to our military partners, JSOC, who swooped in with helicopters to rescue all eight of the former hostages. Within a couple of days, they were reunited with their families. Kala-i-Jangi. In the aftermath of the coordinated air and ground assaults and the fall of major Afghan cities to U.S. and Afghan forces in the north, we encountered a prisoner problem. Our Afghan allies had captured hundreds of the enemy, but had no prison system to process and contain them. The U.S. military had not established any prisoner of war protocols or allocated resources to handle the captured enemy. With the CIA having no writ for prisoners at that time, and not wanting one, and so few U.S. troops being on the ground, the obvious default was to our Afghan allies. So, as with most everything else, they improvised. The single largest group of enemy combatants had surrendered in the Kunduz pocket, where they had been surrounded and assaulted on all sides while being pounded from above. One of our allied commanders in that area, General Dostum, assumed responsibility for a few hundred prisoners. They were a mix of Afghan Taliban and foreign fighters, including the American traitor John Walker Lind. Dostum transported them to the ancient fortress of Kala-i-Jangi, several miles from Mazar-i-Sharif. The massive walls and enclosed compounds resembled some aspects of a prison, but the facility was not configured to screen and control prisoners. Moreover, Dostum's men had no experience in penal operations. They were tribal horse soldiers, not prison guards, and they failed to adequately search the prisoners. On 25 November 2001, during an initial interrogation screening in one of the courtyards, the prisoners revolted. Using concealed weapons in a coordinated assault, they quickly overpowered the Afghan guards and attacked two CIA officers. One of our men, Mike Spann, was immediately overwhelmed. He went down. The other officer, David, fought his way across the courtyard to an interior stairwell. He backpedaled up the steep stairs so he could face the enemy while emptying his AK-47 into the pursuing assailants. He killed several of them. Once at the top of the wall, he found cover. By then, Allied Afghan guards had rallied along the parapets and prevented any breakout, but the mayhem continued. The fighting was intense. David scrambled to safety and met a German news crew. He borrowed their satellite phone and contacted the CIA in Tashkent, who relayed his situation to Team Alpha. They were deployed, in part, still in the Kunduz area. David reported that Mike Spann was down. Within the hour, I got the call at home. It was a Sunday afternoon. I raced to the office at Langley, less than 20 minutes away. The first report, like most, left many questions unanswered. Was Mike dead or alive? Was he wounded or just stunned? Was he captive, or had he managed to escape the onslaught and was now hiding somewhere in the massive compound? I did not know Mike well, but his reputation was solid. He was based in SAD. A Marine who had joined the CIA only a couple of years earlier, he was young, tough, resourceful, and handsome. He was a low-key, quiet, modest professional. He had recently married Shannon, a CIA officer whom he had met during training. I knew Shannon, a CT who had served an interim assignment in CTC the previous year when I was there. She spent a day shadowing me, part of an introductory program I instituted for trainees in CTC. A professor of law, she joined the CIA determined to make a contribution to our counterterrorism mission. Trim, smart, and measured, she was an excellent officer. She and Mike made an impressive couple. Mike had 2 daughters by a previous marriage. Mike and Shannon had a newborn son, Jake. The previous month, just before I departed for Afghanistan, I had asked Shannon if she needed me to take anything to Mike. She gave me a new photo of Jake. While in Afghanistan, I did not see Mike, but had the photo delivered by another officer. It would be the last photo Mike would see of his son. Black, Massey, and I conferred about how to tell Shannon the news. Kofor ordered his deputy, Ben Bonk, to fly to California, where Shannon was visiting family. I sent Massey to Alabama, where Mike's parents lived. Concerned that news of a CIA officer missing in action, MIA, would leak to the press, we telephoned every family of every CIA officer deployed in Afghanistan to inform them that their sons and husbands were okay. Meanwhile, Tenet and I sat together in my small office. We did not know what to say to each other. We sat for a long time. I took phone calls from the field with fragmentary updates. It seemed bad, and I told Tenet. We waited for more news. I had lost fellow CIA officers and foreign agents, some to premeditated violence, others to accidents, and still others to disease. Years earlier, I had escorted the remains of one officer and his widow from an overseas post to the heartland of America, where I met the deceased's family. Only in his 30s, he had died suddenly of a heart attack. I had helped load his body into the casket at the morgue in a city half a world away from his hometown. I had cut a lock of his hair for his widow. I had double-checked with the airlines at all transit stops. He was a good man who served his country honorably. So was Mike, but these circumstances were acutely different. Mike was under my command, and we were at war. The next day, the media had some of the story. The first American to go down in combat after 9/11. But they did not have any details. By now, Massey had arrived in Alabama and informed Mike's parents. Bonk was still en route to California. The Pentagon issued a press statement that the fallen did not belong to the Department of Defense. The statement was not coordinated with the CIA. CIA Public Affairs Officer Bill Harlow called me with the news. I was livid. Why could they not wait another few hours, for God's sake, so we could inform Sharon? What did the Pentagon gain? Maybe Bonk would get to California before Shannon heard the news. Shannon was driving, listening to the radio. She heard the announcement, pulled to the side of the road, and called me.
I just heard a report on the radio that an officer is down. The Pentagon says it's not one of theirs, so he must be ours. It's Mike, isn't it?
The intuition of women, especially for ones they love, surpasses anything I can fathom. She not only already knew it was Mike, she knew he was dead. I could hear it in her voice.